You can have everything in life you want if you will just help other people get what they want. Zig Ziglar.
Welcome to Coach to Scale, how modern leaders build coaching cultures. I'm your host, Matt Benelli. Join me as we build a community of like-minded professionals who share the belief that effective coaching improves the performance of every team member. Our mission is to help leaders become better coaches. The Coach to Scale podcast is sponsored by Coachem, the world's first AI coaching execution platform that leverages evidence-based coaching to increase quota attainment. And with that, let's get started.
My guest today, well, he's got a long history of doing just that. He's a serial entrepreneur. Actually, he's a serially successful human being. He's founded or co-founded Darwin Partners, which sold to Francisco Partners, Stowe Group, which sold to Experis. He's the co-founder of Team Impact, a national nonprofit improving the quality of life for children facing serious illnesses. And he's currently a partner with Oak Wolf Group. Dan Walsh, welcome to Coach to Scale.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Really looking forward to digging into the conversation. Dan, let's get right into it. You've been doing this a long time at a very high level. There's a lot of myths in this crazy business. What's a myth that you've heard time and time again that you know you think is misguided or maybe complete BS?
One myth, and I think Shark Tank's actually helping to demystify this, is you know it's a point at which an entrepreneur is some kind of iconic unicorn. I think everyone's an entrepreneur. I think everyone can be an entrepreneur, and I don't think it takes necessarily a special breed. It takes someone that's got certain attributes, passion, someone that doesn't have a stage of the life when they can assume some risk, like I did. Other than a bar bill, I didn't have a lot when I accidentally started my first company. So I think anybody can be an entrepreneur. I don't think it's some special purpose, iconic unicorn, and more people should do it because it's a ton of fun through the highs and lows, and it's incredibly rewarding upon success, which if you're real focused, you will achieve.
All right, highs and lows. We'll get to both. So Dan, a lot of times as sales leaders, I know I did this. We talked about the importance with the individual contributors, with the reps, of being that CEO of your own business, being that CEO of your own territory. I mean, what's a if you're connecting the dots between being an entrepreneur who really starts their own business and incorporates it versus you're a sales rep with a territory, what's something that is transferable? Like, what is the mindset or a practice that an entrepreneur has that one could have as a rep in his or her territory?
I think it's ownership and belief. We guard against anybody that's a victim of anything. You've got to believe you're in control. You've got to kind of operate with a level of not just excitement, but fear, because you're not working with a net when you're an entrepreneur and the buck stops with you. So I think acting like an owner, thinking like an owner, it's all on you. And if you don't know something or have something, then figure out how to get it. Advocate internally, externally, but really have that accomplish the mission mindset. Whether I make it or not, it's completely up to me. I'm not a victim of anything. If it doesn't go well, I get all the blame. If it goes wildly well, I get all the blame.
Yeah, the personal responsibility, it's that mirror test. If you don't make your number, it's nobody's fault but your own. It's not marketing's fault for not teeing up the leads. It's not the technology's fault for not coming out with the next greatest release, right? It's on you, is what I hear you saying.
100%, and part of that's with selection. Historically, with different colleagues and partners, if through the interviewing process, someone said, well, the marketing over there and the product here, and clearly there are challenges and battles, and sometimes there are things certainly in software where the product necessarily wasn't going to win the war. But if someone is comfortable kind of pointing to all the reasons why they weren't successful, that's a third rail in our shops. That's a level of victimization, a lack of ownership that very respectfully typically ends the interviewing process quite immediately.
Yeah. And you can, as Yogi Berra said, you can observe a lot just by watching, you know, watching and listening to how people react to interviewing questions, you know, who they're blaming for why they didn't achieve the success that they set out to achieve. So Dan, let's talk about beliefs. You mentioned that word. What's a core belief about leadership and coaching that you believe sales leaders would benefit from grasping more firmly?
Belief in general that you can be successful, as simple as that sounds. You know, some people believe if you eat right and exercise, you'll lose weight. And others are saying, well, you know, with my metabolism and, you know, genetically my fit. So I think, you know, believing in cause and effect, believing that you really are in control of what happens, and developing that accomplish the mission mindset, instilling in others that they're in control, that they should believe. So I don't know if that's the most perfect or comprehensive answer, but, you know, I think belief in oneself, belief if you eat right and exercise, you can do well, belief if you study harder, you're going to do better, and that you really are in control and the only person truly blamed.
Well, it's interesting because I think sometimes we try to make mountains out of molehills and we're looking for some answer that's like, wow, I never thought of that. So when you say, you know, if you eat right and exercise, you'll lose weight. And if you believe that, like, it sounds like, yeah, no shit. But that said, there's a lot of people, there's a humongous industry of people that are trying to lose weight and people that are selling them the next best, you know, the latest and greatest solution. But it's really not that hard when you boil it down. Oftentimes, maybe even in the world of sales and business, we try to overcomplicate things. Sometimes it's just as easy as just being simple and executing. Would that be fair?
Yeah. Lifting weights is simple. I'm not saying it's easy, but it is simple. And I do think sometimes people are looking for a silver bullet, and that's both in trying to lose weight and in sales. I think knowing what to do is easy. Eat right and exercise. Doing it's hard. It's change. It's discipline. You know, knowing which people to hire or fire, or how to couch them and bring up a tough topic. Knowing it is easy, especially if you're alone behind the water cooler. Doing it's hard. So, you know, that's true of coaching. And it's certainly true of, you know, a simple analogy like losing weight. So I think the other thing that, to me, even as it relates to the frontline manager and how they coach, they're just one part of a broader system. And in my experience, it could be in technology, it could be in the losing weight example, and it's certainly in sales. You know, there's a whole system in place, and there's no silver bullet. Even a great frontline sales coach isn't going to be able to overcome an environment where the CEO hasn't established a great set of mission, vision, and values. Values like maybe uncommon commitment or egoless or continuous improvement. Values like straight talk. You know, even a great frontline manager, if there's not, you know, a real effective sales methodology in place that people have been taught and trained and coached on, if there's not a good performance management system in place where there's carrots and sticks and there's good measurements that all agree on, you know, what we need to do. You know, those are all parts of a system to include the frontline coaching, the constructive feedback, the effective one-on-ones that make for a successful sales rep. But that is a system. And if it's not working, it's not one silver bullet. It may be adjusting some of the incentives. It may be adjusting, you know, how you go about your one away. So systems improvement is oftentimes a lot of little micro adjustments to the dozen or more dials, not one new dial, or not one. So in the weight loss, you know, you weigh yourself every day. That's an easy one, right? There's your performance. You know, like, you know where you're at. Maybe that day you walk an extra mile or run, or you lay off the fries. You know, I mean, so I do think there is often in life and in sales, like I just need that one silver bullet, as opposed to there's a system of a dozen things I could do differently. I have to adjust them on an ongoing basis and hopefully keep adjusting in a way that's improving so I can continuously improve as an individual, as a coach, and as an overall sales environment, sales system.
Dan, I laugh when you say get on the scale every day. Because as someone who's struggled with weight, despite being, I think, very active, and I've always struggled with weight. And what I say to myself and to others is I've never stepped on the scale after a month and said, wow, I'm a lot lighter than I thought I would be. It's never, ever happened. When I don't get on the scale for weeks at a time and I get on it, I'm like, shit. And I know it. Like, that's probably why I don't get on the scale. But when I weigh myself every day, you know, better things happen. So I think it's a great analogy. That's a discipline. It's a behavior. It's easy to do, right? Just do it every day and you won't go too far off course because maybe you won't have those fries that night, like you said. I do want to bring this up early. I was working for Oracle in Burlington. I worked there for 62 and a half quarters. When you work at Oracle, you measure your life in quarters. And I was in Burlington, and right up the street, you were building a fantastic company at Darwin Partners. And when I was preparing for this interview, I was telling my wife that I was interviewing you today. And she said, Darwin Partners, and she's not in this business at all. She said, okay, and I heard that name over the years. And I said, yeah. And I rattled off 10 people or more that she's probably heard their name over the years that I consider some of the best salespeople that I've had the pleasure of working with. And they all came from Darwin Partners. You built something really, really magical there over the years. When you talk about values, did you have a codified set of values that you and the team at Darwin Partners adhered to? Or was it more just built into the culture and lived out every day?
Well, Oakle was a newer company. We're a couple of years old. And early on with my colleagues and partners here, I made it clear how that shouldn't just be something for the website or in a desk drawer to bring out and polish every now and then. I think it needs to be established early. I need to live by it. You hire based on those values. Those values come up in every one-on-one. You really try to cultivate those values in your environment and in your culture. So, and I think, I don't know the 10 names you have in mind, but hopefully there's a much larger number that really embody a lot of those values. And I think most of those folks are folks we hired off of campus. We hired them and selected them for attributes. Many of them are college athletes that we knew were going to be highly motivated, competitive, coachable, resilient. They've been part of things that are bigger than themselves. Those are all things that, you know, we look for. And then we cultivate and teach things like straight talk, being frank and forthright. We talk about uncommon commitment. We talk about being egoless. So absolutely, to answer your simple question, we have a set of values. We have a set of values here at Oak Wolf. We have a set of values at Team Impact. I think those are critical elements. And I said, you know, it's not just about the frontline coach. It really is a system. And it starts with the CEO or the founders establishing and cultivating and taking, you know, seriously, holding sacred that mission, vision, values, and getting people to buy into it. To me, that's incredibly core and fundamental to an environment, to a high-performing organization, and to a culture.
Awesome. And thanks for sharing that. You talked about environment. You talked about culture. A guest that I had on recently, a guy named John Hunter, used the phrase coaching and leading in wartime versus coaching and leading in peacetime. Wartime, mm-hmm. right, is when maybe the economic climate's not exactly what you want. Businesses aren't going public or getting funded at the level that they may have been in better times, right? We'll call that wartime. Peacetime is when things at the macro level tend to be going very well. So if we just use those terms loosely, is there a difference between how you coach and lead with different macro environments, dare I say wartime versus peacetime?
First off, great sales name, Joe Hunter, or I forget the gentleman's first
John
name.
Hunter, John Hunter, yeah.
John Hunter, yeah. Tremendous sales name. Yes, I think in general, when things are good, I think you have to be harder on people.
All right.
Remember them, you know, what we got here. I think it's more difficult to do that in the tougher times, right? You're still constantly debriefing them the same way. You're still at times ad nauseum trying to reinforce all the same fundamentals of blocking and tackling. I think you need to be more encouraging and motivating during the tough times because there's a lack of that, and not, you know, buy into the rising tide that lifts all boats during the good times. I do think there are differences in subtleties. You know, the blocking and tackling that you're teaching is still the same. But I think, you know, to be tough on a team that's going through tough macro times is not going to be, you know, probably what you want. And trying to keep them grounded during the win streak is sometimes equally as important.
You know, when you said that, it's when times are good, you should probably be tougher on people. I wasn't expecting that, but as I listen to you explain it and I think it makes all the sense in the world.
It's not tough like you become all of a sudden cruel.
Sure.
But I think all of this is about keeping honest people honest. If the tide's, you know, rising and they're feeling pretty good about themselves, but they're not hitting their activity productivity numbers, and you know, A, you should probably change some of your goals, both you know, activity, productivity, and outcome. But I just think to keep people grounded and not say, hey, they're getting the outcomes, you know, we're all set. I think the activity and productivity numbers on a consistent basis, what's really going to continually get results consistently. And I think when times are good, maybe you close a lot of business, you get away from some of those core disciplines, that blocking and tackling, and that means, you know, maybe next quarter's not going to be so good.
My drill instructor has always drilled into us, the more you sweat in peacetime, the less you bleed in war. And so it's hard to remember that when things are going well and, you know, you got to go out there and exert yourself thinking, hey, that's never going to happen. But when things are going well, you have to anticipate around the corner. Eventually, everything's not going to be going swimmingly. And that's really the time that you need to prepare for. And there's many, many different ways of doing that.
And a gal that reported to me, kind of a office of the president back then, she was a Naval Academy grad. She went out to, she did ground support for a Top Gun pilot. And I learned a lot of great military references for her. But as a ground support person, during the day, they back then with pen, they would put your, they would color your log with black pen. And at night they'd do it in red pen. But during war times, they'd use green pen. And you know, the people that had green ink in their log were revered, because they went through the tough times and they were on the front lines. And you know, there have been times, you know, different companies, different phases got through, and sometimes you have to remind people, like, yeah, it is hard. We're going to all get some green ink in our log right now. We're going to get through the other side. We're going to be better off. But what we do in life lives in eternity. So, you know, let's accept that these are tough. Let's accept that we're going to have to double down. We're going to have to even be tighter as a team. You know, no more close copying emails and trying to call other people out. We've got to act, you know, to the nth degree in all the things we teach and preach to get through this tough patch. And when we do, we'll all have green ink in our log. We'll all be better off.
You've mentioned in our prep meeting, and then you mentioned a couple of times, and I wrote it down in my notes, and you mentioned it again just a bit ago.
Part of my charm.
Yeah. You used the phrase, keeping honest people honest. And I was intrigued by it. I don't think I asked you what you meant by that, but this next question might tie back to that. What do the better leaders and coaches do when their employees, when their team members' words aren't backed up with the appropriate actions?
I think that's the perfect example. There's a bunch of core things I need to have in place. We talked at the corporate level, mission, vision, values. You know, there's the comp plan and career path, performance management system. Those are all kind of corporate, could be the CEO, VP of sales, the right tech stack, et cetera. But at the line manager, I think goal setting and establishing personal business plans, where you ask that person, what's important to you? What are your goals personally, financially, from a development perspective. And if you can really get them to think about what's important to them and cultivate, you know, a written document, they come down. And then a week later, a month later, when they're not doing, you know, together you build that plan. If you want to make X, I can build your plan to get there. But it's not going to be showing up late and not paying attention and not taking your personal development seriously. So oftentimes it's a bit of a jujitsu when you use their words against them. You said you want to make 200 grand this year. We agree that that plan would involve these activities, this productivity, you improving, you know, and this particular skill or development, you listening to X number of others, recordings, you breaking down your own and then asking me to constructively critique that. You're not holding up. You're out of the bargain. You no longer want to make 200 grand because your words are so loud. Your actions are so loud, I can't hear your words. So I think that's keeping honest people honest. I'm not yelling at you. I'm not telling you your numbers are low and that's going to affect me. I'm shoulder to shoulder on the same side of the table, look at the same piece of paper that they wrote and then you collaborate on to make sure that a plan for them is going to allow them to achieve the goals that they set. And as long as that goal is above our threshold requirements, performance, you know, I'm comfortable with it. But I think that's the classic example of people keeping honest people honest, and not letting them, you know, say one thing and do another and then be, you know, kind of party witness or complicit in that less than honest exercise because they're not doing what they said they were up for doing in order to get what they said they wanted to achieve.
So I think a big part of what I hear you saying there is that, you know, certainly there's the goal setting process and the mindset there is, you know, people are going to come and work for their reasons, not for their boss's reasons or the company's reasons. They're going to work harder for their own goals. And so it's a worthwhile pursuit for the manager to understand the goals of his or her people. And then to make sure, and here's, I think, the hard part, which is keeping honest people honest. I think a lot of folks that are listening struggle or would feel somewhat uncomfortable if they said, hey, Dan, you mentioned you wanted to make 200 grand this year, but you know your actions aren't backing that up. What gives? Like, do you agree like that's a harder conversation for some, especially newer leaders to have? And what advice would you give them, if so?
I think management and a lot of things, consultative selling, is all about questions. So, you know, have you reviewed your personal business plan lately? How do you think you're doing against it? Really? I'm going to challenge you because from an activity perspective, you know, it's in the document here. You knew that you would have to, in order to make that, this amount, you know, would you agree you haven't? So it can take a while to come up with the right 15 or 20 questions, but you get those right, they feel like a jerk. It's not you yelling at them because, you know, you're not going to hit your number or because the company that's making all this money is going to, you know, somehow suffer in some small way. It's really about that kind of jujitsu, using their words, what they said were their goals. And in that goal setting process, how committed are you to this? Because that's a fair amount. And that's a big step forward from what we saw last year. You know, what changed your situation? Now, what do you want me to do if a week or two into this, you're not doing what you're telling me right now you're committed to doing? And don't say yell at you. Please don't say yell at you. I don't want that either. So I think this is all about asking questions, and questions aren't that intimidating. You know, to tell someone you didn't hit your numbers and you're affecting my goal and now I'm getting yelled at, that to me would be uncomfortable because I'm making it about me.
It's not about you.
It's not about me.
Yeah.
So I don't think that's an intimidating approach where you're saying, how do you think you're giving up your plan? You can use the painful on them. What is going to happen if you don't hit those numbers on a regular basis?
Yeah.
Are you still committed to making 200 grand? Are you doing things that I'm not aware of that you think is going to rectify this anytime soon? How does that affect you personally? Yeah. So I think it's all about asking questions. I think If you have the right pieces in place, you're using the performance management system the company has, the sales incentives, the career path, you're teaching them the system, you're teaching them how to hack the system. I think a huge part of that is keeping them honest with things that they made big commitments to.
And I think the best salespeople ask the best questions, and the best managers ask the best questions, and it's not intimidating. You're as that manager asking, hey, how are you doing against your plan? How are you doing against the goals that you have? And that other person knows the answer. And you both know that not good. You're not doing a good job. You're not doing well, but you're not saying, hey, you're lazy. You're a piece of crap. You're not working hard. You're just asking the questions, and they're coming to that conclusion themselves, which is much more powerful and much less of a pressure situation, awkward situation for the leader. So you gave
some ask more questions. Is there anything else I can do to help you?
Yep.
I'm here as your coach, trying to teach technique and try to motivate you and keep you honest. But I can't pick up the phone for you. I can listen to your recordings. I can give you constructive feedback, which I have. That was part of our personal business plan. That was what I said I would do for you. Is there anything else I can do to help you? Yeah. I mean, ultimately, you get it, so it's no, it's all back on me.
Yeah, and there was, I don't know if you're a basketball.
There's only one person to blame, only one person accountable for their success. I mean, I'm accountable to them on certain things, but ultimately, the things we first started off and taking full ownership, buck stops with me, personal accountability. And if you don't have those people, that's a bigger issue, and you should get HR involved.
And that's a bigger issue if they don't have goals or they're not willing to put the effort in to achieve those goals. Because you, as the leader, you talk, hey, what can I do to help you? But I heard a great quote. I don't know if you're a basketball fan, but watching March Madness over the past weekend, someone quoted the late and former coach of the University of Tennessee, the women's basketball team. I think her name was Pat Summitt. Pat Summitt. And the quote was, I'm not going to coach effort. I'm not going to light your engine. And like, I'll do everything from there, but you got to light your engine and have the effort, and I'll take you from here, there. And she accomplished fantastic things, but I really love that quote. Because like you said, it's tough to light someone's engine and coach effort.
And so this goes back to, you know, a part of that system is the right rubric out front to select the right people. Not those that say they want to work hard, those that have a track record of working hard. I only had, that I'm aware of, two dog-eared, ripped out of the paper by hand quotes on my PC for a lot of years. One was Thomas Edison. Most people don't recognize opportunity because it's dressed in coveralls and looks like work. And the other one was in broken Jersey English by a coach, Bill Parcells. Most people think they want to be great, but they don't. They're not willing to do the work it takes to be great. And that's the God's honest truth. Everybody wants to make the 200 grand because it sounds cool. But that opportunity and Edison's, it takes work.
Yeah.
Parcells will tell you, yeah, most think they do, but they don't because they're just not willing to do the work.
Yeah. And I think part of that quote for Parcells went on to say, if somebody tells you, if somebody is not performing at the level that they should be, but they tell you they're giving it everything they have, then it's time to get somebody else on the team, which I thought
we're in a results business. And I know Parcells says you are what your record says you are.
Yeah.
I think I'm doing great. You are what your record says you are. And that's everything from, you know, activity, productivity, outcome, quality of work. Can't get away from that. That's facing facts, personal accountability, keeping honest people honest.
All right. I'm sure as two Patriot fans, we could go back and forth with a lot of Parcells and Belichick quotes and annoy the rest of the audience, but we won't. Let's keep moving forward. Dan, you mentioned something about, hey, my goal is to make 200 grand a year, whatever the number is. Let's just use 200 grand. You threw that out there. It's often said that monetary goals don't need to be the most important goals for a salesperson. However, how important should money be to a salesperson? You talked about, hey, whatever that number of income that they want to make, it needs to be at or ideally above what their on target earnings is for their comp plan. But can you just talk a little bit about where does money and monetary goals fit in your mind when evaluating and hiring salespeople?
So I think a good personal business plan should be far beyond money to include the things that money would serve as a vehicle to getting. And it shouldn't be just a one-year outlook. You know, the classic, where do you see yourself in 5 years? I want to be a VP of sales. Okay, what do you think that gets there? I have my own opinion as to what it's going to take to get there and the gap between you now and that. But it should be a deeper, broader discussion that's beyond just one figure. It should be personal. It should be the professional development goals that you have and include the financial goals you have, short-term and long-term.
So if you ask somebody, what are your goals? And they say, I want to come in and I want to do good work. I haven't really thought about my goals. And, you know, I made, you know, a little over 100 grand last year. And that's fine. I have a simple lifestyle. I just want to do good work. What do you say to that person?
I would challenge you just to think more deeply and broadly. I want to make sure I have the right person. I mean, if you're in sales, you should be motivated by a number of things. You know, if you're in a self-paced, uncapped environment, you better be taking advantage of that. So some of that's a hiring and selection thing. You know, just doing good work in sales, you know, I don't think that's the a common ambition. I think it tends to be deeper and broader than that. But I would challenge them to really think about it, because I don't think if you have a good sense of your own personal professional goals to include financial, it's a lot harder to motivate and coach that person, because I want to be able to use their goals and their aspirations to help motivate them. Me hitting my goals or getting, you know, the shareholders hit their goals makes my job a lot more difficult. If I can understand what's meaningful to them, to be respected, to be amongst the top 10%, to be in a promotion over the next 12 or 18 months, to make President's Club, whatever it is, it tends to be a lot more about respect and dignity that can also translate obviously into financial goals. But I would not accept that answer. I think you need to go a lot more deep and broad to figure out what that really is, to include asking them to really think about it.
All right. You brought up the importance of interviewing and recruiting. And, you know, I speak to a lot of sales leaders who were frustrated that when they dig into the business, there's too many teams operating not at full headcount. And, you know, there's a specific situation that I've had conversations around this week where the company is closing out their quarter at the end of this month, and the managers have open headcount and, you know, that they're going to need for next year, but they're not interviewing. And the reason why is, hey, I'm trying to close out the quarter. That's just one issue when it comes to interviewing and recruiting. But just in general, what are your thoughts? How do you think about the importance of recruiting and interviewing as part of a manager repertoire, what they do on a daily, weekly, monthly basis?
So I think one of the biggest challenges, whether you're the CEO of the company or a sales manager, is to strike the right balance between working in your business, closing deals, and on your business. You know, the on your business could be some of the things I've touched on. Do we have the right mission, vision, values? Do we have the right sales training? Have we got an effective sales methodology? Do we have the right tech stack? Is it the workflow in that optimized? Do we have the right ops people? You know, do we have the right pricing scheme? Is our customer success? I mean, those are all on the business, not on the phone with the client closing the deal. So to strike that balance is difficult, because the sucking sound is to be in your business, closing deals, peddling fast. But I think there's no way to change gears, no matter how fast you pedal, without dedicating ample time to the on the business type things. So, you know, I'm a big rubric framework. type of person, and you know, to understand some of the things I just said, and just be brutally honest with yourself, and which of those things are kind of red, yellow, green, and you know, what are the timeframes, dates, and deliverables associated with improving those, such that you get to a second or third gear, and the same pedaling would allow you to get a lot further, a lot faster. And whether that's, you know, I need the right recruiting partner or employee value proposition or HR person, that's all comes down to sitting and rolling up your sleeves and thinking and planning, but not just accepting that, hey, my teams are always a little light in terms of headcount. You know, I think that's dedicating, you know, more time, you know, to have kind of half day, one man offsite, just to say, I've got to dedicate some time to working on my team or on my business, as opposed to day to day getting sucked into all the things that are critical and important and urgent. But if you only focus on those, no matter how fast you pedal, you're going to be in that same gear for a while. And it's those on the business things that are kind of the gear shifting things that allow you to go a lot further, faster.
Excellent point. Excellent point.
And to make sure you know who to blame if your team isn't at full headcount.
Which is yourself. So just thoughts just popped into my head. You know, I hear a lot. I don't have any openings right now. You know, doesn't make sense for me to talk to so-and-so. I'm at full headcount. And it kind of leads me to believe that, you know, to question whether how important is it for managers, for sales leaders to be interviewing even when they don't have any open spots on their team. Is that something that you'd advocate?
It's an incredibly powerful situation when you're always recruiting, or you have the discipline of always recruiting, or you have the relationships with recruiting firms that know anybody and everybody that fits this rubric for me, I'll talk to them forever and always. I think there are folks that have headcount that's missing, and a couple of people at the back of the bus that, you know, had you opportunities to top grade, you do it, but you kind of, you know, begrudge the whole idea of, oh, I have to start spending time on that or take too long to, you know, whether at the business level or sales manager level, having great vendors is critical. Yeah. You know, you should keep looking until you have a vendor that really understands your company, your culture, what you're looking for, and can constantly be tempting you to whether it's fill those slots or overhire or hire ahead or top grade. I think that's critical. And it's a discipline, and it's a working on your business discipline. When you do that, you know, you're going to be in much better shape. And no matter how fast you're pedaling, if you're three headcount down and the two of the ones you do have for headcount are not really cutting it and take a lot of your time, that's tough to compete with the person who says, yeah, I don't spend as much time in the deals, when I got full headcount and they're all, you know, more than capable of hitting their target or stretch goals.
ABR, always be recruiting. It's a mindset, it's a discipline. Powerful. It gives you confidence to
ABR and RPRR, right people, right roles. Always right people, right roles. And that's both on your team and your organization and even your vendors. Have you got the right vendors that are playing the right role to include to tempt you to maybe top grade, to make sure you're never, you know, not at full headcount. And that can take some work. It takes you away from, you know, driving deals. But I think it's a critical on the business exercise that can set you up for longer term success with less stress. Pedaling fast is hard. Being in third gear, pedaling slowly is going to be better than the guy, you know, blowing gaskets in first gear, trying to close those deals because his team's not ideal.
So, Dan, right people, right roles. Is that also a situation where you could have someone that's exhibiting a lot of the right qualities? They're putting the work in, but they're not achieving the results that you or they want to achieve. But they might be in slightly in the wrong role, and you put them in a different seat, and they can be successful on your team or in your organization. Is that part of right people, right roles, or are you thinking differently?
It's a huge part of right people, right roles. And they may be a better fit in another organization.
Yeah.
We used to go through this exercise, you know, kind of a 2x2 grid, you know, what do you love to do? What are you great at? What don't you like to do? What aren't you good at? And part of the exercise was shame on us, especially if they were talented and motivated and coachable. If we can't get you to do the stuff you love to do and you're great at, and try to minimize the things you don't like to do and aren't good at, you know, so, you know, some people, they hire a bird and a rabbit and a fish, and they go through some assessment and they said, wow, this fish can swim, but hopping and flying, big problem. Let's get him in a training lab, you know, and that bird, I'll tell you what, a little bit of hopping, but absolutely soars when it comes to flying, you know, not more of a floater than a swimmer, you know, get them in the training lab as opposed to let the fish swim, let the bird fly. So I think getting the right people in the right role is an ongoing exercise and discipline. But, you know, what do you love to do? What are you great at? What don't you like to do? What aren't you good at? That can help someone kind of self-actualize, like, yeah, maybe I'm better off as an AM than an AE, or as a simple example. And I think most people realize it. All you're doing is keeping them honest about it and tabling as a way to try to, you know, share the obligation to get you in the right role.
That seems like a great interview question. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Could have been the way you structure the team.
Yeah.
Could be a lot of different things, but let's accept that, you know, that fish in the water is going to dominate and feel pretty good about themselves. But if you're asking them to fly, a lot of tension and not a lot of personal, professional, financial fulfillment, to use, you know, rudimentary example.
That seems like a great interview question. What do you like to do, and what do you think you're really good at, and what don't you like to do, and what are you not good at, and seeing how much candor you get. That seemed like that would be a really powerful
candor, self-awareness.
Yeah. You know, I joke, and I've recently shared it with my son, who's just entering into the profession. People ask you, hey, well, you know, what's something, you know, that you kind of ding yourself on? What's something, you know, you're not really good at, or you think you've been criticized for? And, you know, over the years, I always laugh at the answers. Oh, I work too hard. I care too much.
I'm a perfectionist.
Yeah. I could have a whole conversation around that. Hey, let's switch gears a little bit, Dan. I really love the questions and the points that you're bringing up. And I mentioned you've had an excellent career, an admirable career so far. What's an accomplishment about which you're most proud?
Team Impact's the most rewarding thing I've ever done. You mentioned the March Madness. We had 42 kids on the 64 teams. I think we still have like six or seven left. So I made your initial quote was about giving back, and to see that, I mean, same kind of planning, all the same principles, even though it's a not for profit. So that'd be, you know, first and foremost.
Can you explain that a little
bit? Most rewarding.
Can you explain that a little bit more, like what you just said, like in what Team Impact does?
So Team Impact essentially is like a Make-A-Wish meets Big Brother, Big Sister. We take kids with serious illnesses, and it's supposed to send them to Disney World. We get them to be drafted by college athletic teams near where they live. And for the next 2 years, while they're going through hell at the hospital, and when they show up to middle school, they're often in a wheelchair, perhaps bald and teased mercilessly. They're the big man at campus across town, because for the next 2 years, to the greatest extent possible, they are a full-fledged member of that team. Locker, gear, show up at games, banquets, keep in touch with the teammates, you know, throughout the season. There is no off-season. There's plenty online to learn more about Team Impact, but that's what we do.
And there's a lot of people listening that are their ears perked up, and they believe in giving back, and they were likely inspired by what you just talked about with Team Impact. What is team like for people out there? How can people help Team Impact if they so chose? What's Team Impact looking for? Or what
it's
do you
as
need?
Simple as just following us on social media and forwarding us. I mean, a fair amount of our effort is finding more teams and finding more kids that are deserving. So even just to promote us is our sales effort, our outreach, as they say, a nonprofit. That goes a long way, because there's 500,000 kids a year getting diagnosed with serious illnesses. We've got an incredible network of teams. We are in 50 states. We are in 850 campuses. We're making a few matches a day these days, but we're always looking for more kids. We're always looking for more teams. So just to follow us, promote us, and join our outreach efforts would be a huge help. Obviously, through that, any kind of donations are always appreciated. We have events both for young professionals and a handful of cities across the country. You can participate, learn more about it, hear the actual participants speak. And the other thing that has been the most rewarding for me is just seeing young folks that you hire that you know are motivated and coachable and seeing them flourish, seeing them, you know, achieve new levels of fulfillment personally, financially, professionally. By far the most rewarding thing, especially when you really do understand what their goals are and you feel you've played some part in helping them achieve them. The level of confidence that comes from that, you know, where they go, I think that's by far, you know, the most rewarding thing. To include that Team Impact folks that we hired earlier that have gone out to do great things and be part of a great cause and a shared mission.
Awesome. I'll follow you on social media. I'd love to learn more about it. And we will also share the link when this episode gets published, so more people can become aware if they so choose.
You wouldn't want to follow me, but certainly follow Team Impact.
Absolutely. I'm with you there. You got an extra follower in me, and we'll make sure other people know where to find it if they so choose to do so. It sounds like a phenomenal cause. So as we move to close out, Dan, you know, this program's called Coach to Scale. So the people listening care. They give a crap about coaching and developing people and watching other people flourish like you do. And people who have devoted so much time to it as you have typically have had that behavior modeled for them in some way, sometimes a lot, sometimes once, sometimes they knew it was coaching at the time. Otherwise, sometimes they thought it was onerous. But is there somebody that made a difference in your life or in your career, someone where you received great coaching that you look back on from time to time and say, wow, that was really impactful to me?
As I mentioned, I'm kind of an accidental entrepreneur. You know, the economy was bad and didn't necessarily set out to start what became Darwin over those years. So there's a little bit of a homegrown. I wish I had, you know, more mentors early. I was always trying to figure it out. But I knew the buck stopped with me. So I had to just work a lot harder, figure stuff out, make a lot more mistakes. I did have a world-class board at Darwin. Folks that had started companies, built them, taken them public, run, big companies. And they were helpful in a number of ways. But it wasn't kind of day-to-day coaching, more like just good perspective on, kind of strategic planning and even how to communicate, you know, at a corporate level. Those people were certainly helpful to me. But, you know, day to day, I just worked harder and made more mistakes than everybody else to figure out what works. So, but I don't recommend it to anybody.
Yeah.
I paid my tuition payments the hard way. Find a mentor, find someone that has been successful, learn from all the mistakes they made.
Right. Yeah. It's the school of hard knocks. It's not something you want to sign on to voluntarily. It's usually you don't have another choice and you make the best of it. But yeah, no, that's excellent advice about not going it alone and finding a mentor and appreciate you bringing up the world-class board. Sometimes people and companies forget to surround themselves with people who are like-minded, but also have different skill sets than they do. On the topic of coaching, you've brought up a couple, but who's your favorite coach? Either a fictional Ted Lasso type coaches or a real coach, but someone that most people would know the answer. Someone whose name most people would be familiar with.
Well, I think I'm going to answer that in an interesting way, because you mentioned Coach to Scale. I'm not saying he's my favorite, but what I like about Coach Saban is everyone says he has a system. And I think, believe it or not, I've spent some time in the college athletic coaching arena. And most people don't have a system. And I'd submit that a lot of people in sales and variety of industries don't have a system. So to scale, you need a system. You need a framework and a rubric for who you hire. You need a framework and a rubric for how you measure them. You need a very well-defined career path with carrots and sticks, all documented, well-defined, costly communicated. That's how you scale. Even hustling and pedaling fast, if you don't really have a well-defined set of frameworks and rubrics and checklists that you train to and coach to, I think you're left to just hoping that each individual's heroics or interpretive art form is somehow going to come together. I've long considered heroics, which some people take pride in, as a weak excuse for poor process. It shouldn't take heroics. It should take a good process that people have been coached to and trained to and follow and motivated to follow. So, I think documenting processes, frameworks, rubrics, how you do things, and once they're documented, they keep getting better. You go from version 1 to 1.1, and then version 1.2, and then someone comes up with a great idea, and you go to version 2. So if you're not disciplined about that, I think it's going to be a lot more difficult to scale.
Yeah. Can't scale success by brute force.
And, there's another, and I don't know, millennials, Gen X, Z, I think sometimes it's a bad rap that they, they're not patient enough and just, bide your time, over time, you'll do well too. I think some of their questions are helpful for a company and sometimes expose a lack of well-documented processes, career paths, incentives, carrot sticks. You should have an answer for them, a very clear and consistent one too. What do I need to do to get to my next promotion? What do I need to do to make 100, 200 grand? That shouldn't be a soft kind of, just keep doing what you're doing and over time it'll all happen. I don't think that's a good answer. And I think it's actually a really fair question. And you should have a really strong, very discreet, and hopefully documented answer. Let me walk you through the career path. Here's how you'll be measured, objectively and subjectively. And if you achieve not just these numbers, but if you become, contributing to us in terms of, your knowledge, your process improvement, or, think about what it would take for them to get ahead further, faster. Document it. Coach them to that. When they ask that answer, say, great question. I'm glad you asked. I want you to know that because hopefully that'll motivate you to go further, faster, with less of me trying to coach you up and light your fire, or as Pat Summitt said, kind of get you off the couch.
So instead of what I'm hearing you say there, instead of these salty, grizzled veterans bitching about the younger generation, perhaps like just look in the mirror and say that that's the younger generations are keeping honest people honest.
And yes.
Yeah.
Now you should have a great answer for that. The person asking for that, if they're willing to do the work, is a gift to you. Because if you give them an answer and says you'd have to do all these things, hopefully they'll go do them and they will go further, faster, to include hitting their numbers and developing their skills and being better positioned for a raise or a bonus or a promotion.
Well, Dan, this has been fantastic. I mean, we've covered a lot of ground and I appreciate the time you've invested with us, with me. We talked about the importance of rubric and frameworks. We talked about the importance of recruiting and selection, right people, right role, ABR, always be recruiting, personal responsibility, goal setting, and seeing other people.
Working on the business and in the business, make sure you've got a culture that allows the frontline manager to be successful. Without mission, vision, values, without personal business plans, without a performance management system, that frontline manager is going to have a real tough time. But if you surround them with that and they understand that system, they should be able to coach people to that system. And that's a lot more scalable.
Dan, before we take off, do you have any advice for folks that are – let me frame it, especially for people who are newer in the profession, right, in sales, and they're not getting what they need from their manager. And it's on this question's about like almost like how do you manage your manager? But a lot of people will struggle with that, especially people who are newer in their career. What advice would you have for that person who's struggling to get what they need from their manager, but they really want that help and that guidance?
So this is going to sound like a familiar refrain. I'd figure out the right 10 or 15 questions to ask them.
And if they don't get the answers if they don't get helpful answers.
I'd find the next person to keep asking. I don't know if it's a colleague or you ask someone, a different manager or director or VP, but, what could I be doing better? I'm struggling to hit certain things. Why do you think that is? What advice would you give me? Are there additional tools or training you think I would benefit from? I don't know the exact right questions, but I wouldn't say my coach sucks. I wouldn't look at them silently talking about their behind their back. I'd remind them, I am committed to my personal business plan. I do want to make that 200 grand. I accept I'm not where I need to be. I'd love your input as to what I can be doing better or differently. Do you have prescriptive skills? Is there a different rep I should be listening to their phone calls for? Ask those right. You have to own it. It's your personal accountability. Hopefully your coach is good and helpful. If not, ask them those questions to kind of pull it out of them. Maybe they don't feel comfortable telling you those things. If they don't, ask others.
Keep asking. Keep asking.
Find some mentors. But figure it out. FITFO.
Awesome advice. Dan, thanks so much for investing time with me today. Appreciate it.
A pleasure.
All right. And to all of you out there, thanks for listening. If you learned something today, if you laughed, tell someone about the podcast, Coach to Scale, comment, engage online. Tell us what you like. Tell us what you don't like. Tell us what you'd like to see and hear more of. We want to bring the best guests, the best content to you. It's been my pleasure to host this conversation on behalf of Coach to Scale. And until next time, coach them if you want to keep them.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Coach to Scale, How Modern Leaders Build Coaching Cultures. For show notes and other episodes, visit us at coachem.io. That's coachem.io. And follow us on Twitter at coachemnow. See you all next week. Thanks for joining. And remember, coach them if you want to keep them.